tells Wired the directory surfaced via an anonymous FTP. Oh, I love it. They're using 1990s technology to get all this information. A source separately provided Wired with the registration list for Dialogue's 2026 retreat, which, oh, this is interesting. It's happening the same weekend as Hope. Did you know that?
Yeah, I saw that.
Oh, my goodness. Wow, it's happening August 12th through 16th at a venue near Dublin, Ireland. Okay, now we have a new workshop.
I think so. I think a remote workshop. We'll have some of our session leaders visit. And
I just saw this as I was reading.
That's okay.
Well, anyway, they named 222 people on records. Records what the list describes as East registrants, membership status, and attendee type, including active member and guest. Wow. Any thoughts, guys, on this? This is fun.
Oh, it's a lot of fun. And, I guess Elon Musk is going to have to make a choice which event he wants to go to since they're competing. But the funniest part about this, you had mentioned they're using FTP and they're using ancient technology and, you know, security through obscurity, and it all falls to pieces. But you would expect, like, sort of the not greatest but richest minds on the planet would, I don't know, come up with something a little better.
The documents show an extraordinary convergence of power, the registration records list. General Alexis Grinevich, NATO's supreme allied commander. Well, yeah, we didn't get them, that's for sure. The head of U.S. European Command, who took the post in July 2025, and has attended Dialogue gatherings since 2021. The website directory names sitting Trump administration officials, two U.S. senators, six members of the PayPal mafia, a former Middle East chief of intelligence, and a sitting ambassador to the United States, along with the founders and directors of many of the country's largest surveillance data broker and advertising data companies. Wow. It's still going to be a better conference in New York, I think, than this. My God. Those executives appear side by side with senior U.S. officials overseeing their industries. There's all kinds of names here, but boy, what a story. Go ahead, Alex.
I mean, this seems to me like, on the one hand, people can gather with whomever they want in a private place and have a private conversation, and we shouldn't really fault them for doing that in some ways, right? But it's quite obvious, given the types of people who are gathering and the political influence that's there, that it's different. It's a different kind of gathering. It's not just a difference of degree. It's a difference of kind here. And I think the difference is that this begins to look a lot like some kind of secretive governance layer here, where the point is almost like the opposite of Hope. It's like the opposite of a hacker conference for elites, because the product is influence that they're peddling here. They get to meet in private, workshop these ideas about what they're going to do in public life, and then emerge with some kind of consensus among the elites about those particular types of ideas. And they do it secretly. They don't do it openly. They don't do it with a live stream from the Internet Society pushing this out like we do. They don't do it where anybody can buy a ticket and show up to the conference. It's an invite-only secret governance layer. It's the type of stuff that conspiracy theorists run amok with.
Absolutely, yes. We're going to continue this conversation on overtime because we are out of time right now, but you can write to us here at Off the Hook, oth@2600.com. And I want to close off with this Brazilian song, by Jorge Menjor from his 1976 album. It's all about an African striker, and I think it's particularly apropos today after seeing the game with Democratic Republic of Congo in the World Cup. It's been described as possibly one of the best songs about sports ever written, and not a word of it is in English. So, enjoy the melody at least, and visit us over on Overtime. We're starting that conversation at 8 p.m. Go to Channel 2600 on YouTube or simply click on the link on 2600.com. See you next week.
Polak, Kuro Kondo, Shaka Polak, Jogato, Shaka Polak, Kuro Kondo, Hiri Hiri Hiri, Jogato, Hiri Hiri Hiri, Kuro Kondo, Hiri Hiri Hiri, Jogato, Hiri Hiri Hiri, Kuro Kondo.
Hello and welcome to the Eurasian Knot. I'm your host, Sean Guillory. No Rusana this week. She's out camping in some forest in Northern California to celebrate her birthday. So happy birthday to Rusana. This is the Eurasian Knot, which is sponsored by the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Pittsburgh, and patrons who give monthly contributions to show us how much they appreciate this show. If you want to help us out, please consider becoming a patron by going to patreon.com/eurasianknot or to the podcast website, eurasianknot.org, and find that link to Patreon and sign up and become a monthly patron. So this is kind of a special episode because when I opened Facebook this morning, which I do pretty much every morning, I learned that Alexander Rabinowitz died at 91 years old. Now, for those of you who might not know, Rabinowitz is arguably one of the most important historians of the Russian Revolution, and I had the honor of interviewing him way back in 2017 during the 100th anniversary of the revolution. And now that he's left us, I figured, you know, I went through my archive and dug out an old interview, the old interview I did with him, and I cleaned it up, and I decided to re-release it just to commemorate his life and the work of this scholarly giant. Alexander Rabinowitz was a professor emeritus of history at Indiana University, where he taught from 1968 till 1999, and he wrote four books on the Russian Revolution. The first, Prelude to Revolution, the Petrograd Bolsheviks and the July 1917 Uprising. The second, the Bolsheviks Come to Power, the Revolution of 1917 in Petrograd. Then, third, the Bolsheviks in Power, the first year of Soviet rule in Petrograd. And finally, his fourth and last book, which just happened to be published this past April, The Bolsheviks Survive, Petrograd 1919, which was published by the University of Pittsburgh Press. So here is my interview with Alexander Rabinowitz from 10 years ago now. Rest in peace. Thank you for all your wonderful scholarship about the revolution, and I hope your listeners enjoy it. Here's Alexander Rabinowitz.
So
The Russian Revolution has been with you, I think it's safe to say, your entire life, beginning with your parents and growing up in a Russian immigrant community yourself in the United States, which included some pretty prominent people. In an essay you wrote recently, you noted that Vladimir Nabokov, Alexander Kerensky, and Boris Nikolaevsky, among other people, were summer guests to your parents' house. So I thought we'd start by having you talk about your family history and your memories of the immigrant community and its influence on your study of the Russian Revolution.
Sure. I was born in London, England, with my twin brother in 1934. And for most of my life, and as far back as I can remember, we were always surrounded by Russians. Of course, I don't remember those London days because we left when I was 4 years old. But and my father immigrated, and my mother and the family on the eve of the war. But I do remember, to some extent, the war years. My father was a very prominent scientist. He was born in St. Petersburg. He was a physical chemist. He was a biologist and a poet, fancied himself an architect as well. Always felt tied to St. Petersburg. I wrote poetry about St. Petersburg, some of which was published. Talked about the revolution, his experience of 1917 when he was a student, St. Petersburg University, when we were growing up. My mother was less political. She was born in Zhytomyr in Ukraine, and they both immigrated from Russia in 1918, around the time of the start of the Red Terror in Russia. My twin brother and I learned Russian before English. And I do remember my first sort of recollections. My dad got his first job at MIT. And there, his closest friend and my mother's closest friend were the Karpovich family, who lived in Cambridge. He was at Harvard. Karpovich was, the father of Russian. It's generally acknowledged as the father of Russian studies in the United States and the Russian history. It didn't publish as much as he might have, but was really prominent, had started some of the most important historical journals for Russian immigrants in Russian culture. And the Karpoviches had a large farm in southern Vermont, in the mountains, in the Green Mountains, a beautiful spot. They had maybe 150 acres, a lot of which wood covered. But every summer, almost from the time we got there, that was kind of a gathering place for some of the most prominent people in the Russian immigration in the East Coast of the United States, not just in Boston. And so you mentioned Nabokov, I think, and Karpovich and Boris Nikolaevsky. Boris Nikolaevsky was more at our place. I'll talk about that in a second. But there's a lot of people, George Vernadsky, the historian, Fedotov, the religious historian, philosopher, Timashev, the sociologist, all very prominent people with their wives and with their family. And in terms of how it impacted my thinking, there's no doubt that first stirred my interest in Russian history and Russian studies, although in a very amateurish way, but in a mixed way. I mean, on the one hand, I soaked it up, and Russian history and Russian culture was a vague part of me, and more as I grew up. On the other hand, it was during the Cold War. I can remember getting on a bus, a streetcar in Cambridge, and my mother speaking Russian, and me wanting to run to the back of streetcar so nobody would know that we were Russian. So it's a mixed thing, but I suppose the biggest impact, I think, was that all of the Russians I knew had been forced to leave Russia or felt pressed to leave Russia. Some were forced out. They had been the losers in the way the revolution had turned out had swung in October 1917 with the coming of the Bolsheviks to power. They all saw Lenin and the Bolsheviks as evil, as the incarnation of evil. They viewed the Bolshevik seizure of power as a coup d'etat, well-organized, but against the wishes of the bulk of the Russian population. And Lenin is most of all a masterful, and Trotsky, masterful leaders and rigidly enforcing discipline that, which explained why they were so successful.
Right. So let's talk a bit about your relationship with Boris Nikolaevsky, because he was a prominent Menshevik. He was the de facto historian, one of the main historians of Russian social democracy. And he also, you know, served as a mentor for you, I think, you know, outside of your academic life, and also was really helpful in your research and in publishing your first book. So what kind of influence did he have on you and how you approached the subject of the revolution?
Well, you know, there's some things that are a little bit incorrect in a minor ways in what you just said. And Nikolaevsky was sort of an uncle. He was a wonderful man. He didn't speak much English at all. You'd ask him at the table to pass the butter and he'd give you the salt. He worked from morning till night. His only break came when he walked with us to the village to get the mail, and he got 90% of the mail because he had a correspondence from all around the world. But he was part of what influenced me to study the Russian Revolution. But he didn't have the impact on me that some of my professors, Leopold Haimson at the University of Chicago, had, and John M. Thompson at Indiana University. Haimson, who was a professor of history and specialist in Russian labor history and social history, and Thompson, who was a diplomatic historian, but a wonderful and a very inspirational teacher, sadly recently died. They had a greater influence in me, specifically in terms of my work. And Nikolaevsky's main role, I mean, he had been a leading Menshevik in 1917, even though he was very young. He had known Lenin. He had walked out of the Second Congress of Soviets hand in hand almost with Markov, Yuli Markov, the leading Menshevik internationalist and opponent of Lenin. So he was a political figure, and he published the leading Menshevik immigrate journal, the Socialistический Вестник, for many years. So, yeah, he was an important scholar, but his main contribution came from the fact that he was the archivist of the Social Democratic Movement. He had come into possession of the Marx archive, and Stalin made efforts to get it when Nikolaevsky was in Germany, made efforts to get it through Bukharin, that's where the letter to an old Bolshevik came from. And he had an enormous, enormous library, most of which was saved, hidden during World War II. Nikolaevsky managed to get to the United States. It was successfully hidden and then brought to the United States. So I was often in his apartment just off the Columbia campus, a large apartment, double apartment, and it was floor-to-ceiling books and manuscripts. Somehow he would find them, but they were sagging. And he would advise me once in a while on bibliography, but we just didn't talk much about my work. Very limited, maybe because I was so frantic about doing my research. Actually, I would say this. I regret the fact that the people I knew are no longer with us. And that dates back to the 1970s. I mean, I continue. Boris Ivanovich Nikolaevsky could have helped me with this. He would have known the answer to this. He would know where to get this. I say that today. And about other people that I knew. Unfortunately, they're not here, and I didn't draw on them as much as I could have or should have when I could have.
Let me ask you about that, because you are surrounded, for a lot of your young life, you are surrounded with these people who experienced the revolution firsthand, who experienced the difficulty of getting out of the country and being immigrants in Europe and then the United States. Did you take that for granted to some extent, or did you not have the consciousness at the time to maybe think, how can I, like in terms of like recording these people, or maybe this wasn't your part?
I was just too young. Really, I have these vague memories. I mean, I interviewed Kerensky a couple of times, and so I have an image of him, and we had conversations with him. I can talk about that if you want. He was the main prime minister of Russia and the prime minister of the provisional government when the Bolsheviks took power. But I, you know, from my childhood days, I remember his shoes better than I do what he said, because I was crawling under the table.
Well, so you set off to do a dissertation on the Russian Revolution, and your dissertation eventually becomes your first book, Prelude the Revolution, the Petrograd Bolsheviks and the July 1917 Uprising. Now, instead of going through all your books one by one, I want to get your general, you know, you've written this trilogy over the last, you know, several decades about the Russian Revolution. What are some of your main takeaways that one should get from your work in reading these books? And how did working on the history of the revolution change your understanding of it based on your earlier personal experiences with people you were growing up around?
Well, it was taken by Tsaritelli and was so negatively sort of influenced against the revolution, against everything Soviet, that my first choice for a doctoral dissertation was a biography of Tsaritelli. And we bogged down because I didn't know George, and a lot of his formative experiences were only available in Georgian sources. And it so happened that Philip Moseley, he was a leading diplomat, he was a leading historian. He was really, the founder of Russian studies, or one of the founders at Columbia University. He was director of the Russian Institute at Columbia University. And he was very close to emigres. He was one of the real fathers of Russian studies, the founders and builders of Russian studies in the United States, behind the grants that the Ford Foundation put into Russian studies, etc. And he had happened on the campus, Indiana campus, at the invitation, I think, Bob Burns. And I told him my dilemma with Tsaritelli, and he said, well, why not study Tsaritelli in 1917? So he did. And as I got into the newspapers and into the sources that were available to the United States, I quickly became fascinated by history of Bolshevism in Petrograd, and the picture that emerged from sources that I was looking at were radically different from what I was getting from emigre memoirs, from what I had gotten in Kerensky, what I had gotten in a vague sense from Nikolaevsky, and from what I heard secondarily from the people around me since I was a kid. And one of the subjects that seemed most interesting was the July uprising, which had been a historical puzzle. I felt I had resolved it, but it took months and months of very close research in primary sources. And that sort of started me, once I had published a book which had Prelude to Revolution, the Petrograd Bolsheviks and the July uprising, and it had been quite a big success in this country. In Russia, I was considered, Soviet Russia, I was considered a bourgeois falsifier, but here I really got a warm reception, and I really got intrigued by the history of the revolution and the new things I was finding out about it. So then I went on to the October Revolution and did my second, The Bolsheviks Come to Power, and I finished that book. This was subsequently the first book on the Russian Revolution by a Western historian published in the Soviet Union under Gorbachev, and I finally was out from under the nickname and the suggestion that I was a falsifier. But that October book and the July book reflected an image of the Bolshevik Party and of the revolution and of the Bolshevik success in radically different ways than had been the case before. There seemed to be, for old school historians, for the traditional view, for the immigrant-influenced view, there was a straight line between the narrow coup d'etat and centrally organized by Lenin and the Stalinist dictatorship. But that wasn't true for me because I had seen October as, in a very real sense, a reflection of popular sentiments, the Bolshevik Party not as a narrow conspiratorial party, but as a mass party that had very popular slogans and programs, and that was successful because it had linkages in factories and in military units and among Baltic Fleet sailors, and because its slogans, all part of the Soviets, peace, land, and bread, were immensely, immensely popular. They seemed to ordinary Russians, in Petrograd at least, as best reflecting their needs and their aspirations and their best bet for realizing them. But that created a problem because how was then one to explain how Soviets were so quickly turned into the secondary institutions ruled by the party, and how Russia, Soviet Russia, became centralized and authoritarian, a party-ruled state, so relatively quickly. And so that led me to my next book, The Bolsheviks in Power, the First Year of Soviet Rule in Petrograd, and my present study on the Petrograd Bolsheviks Survive, Petrograd during the Civil War. And so July led to where I am now, and I often wish I had somehow freed myself and done some other things, but there it is.
Yeah. Let me ask you about that, too, in the sense of, so your first book, when was the first time you did research in the Soviet Union, and what was your experience like there?
I had gotten married to my wife of 53, 4 years in 1963. And she was also in Russian history. We had met at a Quaker seminar. And anyway, the two of us went on one of the early exchanges to the Soviet Union in 1963-64. The exchange had been going on for a few years by then, but relatively speaking, it was early phase of the exchange. And it was during the Khrushchev era, the last year of Khrushchev reign as general secretary of the Communist Party and leader of the Soviet government. We had a wonderful experience. It started out very sadly, relatively sadly, but with an episode that was reflective of the situation then. We were living in the dorm at MGU. Word came that Kennedy had been assassinated. Actually, we first found out that Kennedy had been assassinated when we saw a big banner on our dorm, on the building. The Russian students had already written our sympathies to our American guests, or something like that. And we were surrounded by love, really. I don't want to be naive about it. I'm not sure that was by any means true of everybody. But anyway, we did find an awful lot of very, very people who became very dear friends who were with us in the dorm. And we did find during that period, the Khrushchev era, quite a bit of receptivity among students and to some extent scholars in Russia. But we had no access to archives. But we had been warned by security personnel and the embassy to be careful and that we were being listened to and all sorts of things, and perhaps we were, and probably we were. But we didn't feel it, and we developed close relationships with Russians and had a very productive year. I really think that year made my career in the sense that I was able to use the sources that were little used and provided the insights that were the key to understanding the July uprising.
You're working on a fourth book during the to Petrograd Bolsheviks in the Civil War. And looking back on your three books and then also the book you're working now, and when you reflect on your work as a historian of the revolution, how do you understand what your intellectual project has been? And what would you do differently if you could?
I'm not sure I would do anything differently. I had drawn from Hameson and Thompson a love of historical research, a belief that while any historical research years after the time, you might try to be objective and you can try to be to do sort of a photograph, but you can't ever do it. But to the degree that you could find sort of mutually supporting evidence, and the more evidence, the better, and the different kinds of evidence, the closer you could come. And so it was a thrill. It was kind of a detective work that I really came to love. And then when it was appreciated by reviewers, and that Mike Guggenheim or an Institute for Advanced Study or whatever, recognizing some value in the work that I was producing, it just turned me on to trying to go further and to help answer the implications of the work I'd done.
Now, there have been many, many, many books about the Russian Revolution over the decades. And what kind of questions of personal interest to you feel remain unresolved?
There has been some of the most significant holes in research have started to be filled in the revolution in the provinces, the histories of other parties, gender history, women's history, has started to be filled. Sadly, the political history of the Bolsheviks, there's been an assumption, I don't think I've ever been very successful, because I think there's the idea that the revolution was a coup is still very strong in this country, and maybe it's stronger now, and it is certainly strong in Russia. The most ridiculous kinds of ideas are floating around now, and we can talk about it if you want. But there are huge volumes of documents have been published on other political parties, but not the Bolsheviks. And a lot of the material that we have is incomplete and distorted by comments, and an awful lot is not published. And so I would say, just in a general way, what do we need to study? We need to study everything. We really need to redo all the work, because my experience is that there's an enormous amount of fresh information, little used information, that hasn't been used and that is vitally important for understanding the process. And without understanding what the revolution was, you can't begin to learn the lessons from it. Some people are interested in lessons from it because it is for the instruction and for the insights it gives into making revolution. They are revolutionaries. They're Marxists. I am not. And so for me, the value, my work, to me, if we want to look at it in a contemporary political sense, is what the revolution shows, what the lessons are of the revolution have for people that want to avoid revolution. To me, the lesson is that we need to resolve fundamental political, social, and economic issues, the needs of people generally, if we are going to avoid revolutions. And revolutions on a scale as they occurred in Russia, profoundly dangerous. We see from the Russian experience what happened. It's far better, it seems to me, to resolve them before they reach the revolutionary stage. But to understand that,
you have to understand what the revolution was about. So, what was the revolution in what you've been studying for decades? What would you say the revolution was about?
People wanting a better life, a part of. Well, to some extent, survival. But anyway, to overcome poverty, to have the opportunity to better themselves, to have an opportunity to reach their highest personal possibility.
Now, you've naturally been in high demand of late. You know, you've been participating in numerous conferences and lectures and interviews, both here in the United States and abroad, and you've been traveling a lot to Russia. So what has your experience been like in reevaluating the Russian Revolution 100 years later? What kind of things do you find audiences interested in? What kind of questions do they ask you?
Just recently, I spent a week in Russia, in Moscow, and I'm going to St. Petersburg for a month and a half on Sunday, and I'll be participating in some conferences and giving some talk. In Moscow, I was struck by the absolutely crazy questions I was being asked. You know, was there a February Revolution? Is it true that everything was great in Russia in February, and it was the generals or the Masons or the intelligentsia that caused the revolution? And this to some extent is being encouraged. The idea that the empire, Imperial Russia, was strong and that is where Russia's future lies, I think, is being encouraged by the regime, which really cannot just ignore the revolution. And so it is helping fund serious scholarly conferences, but at a popular level, that's not what's happening. And crazy things are being published, crazy things are being said, and these lead to crazy questions. I don't want to go too far with that, because the people that tend to go to my talk or to these conferences are bright and special. But I certainly get that as I read about popular thought in newspapers and in some of the questions that I get.
And then what about within the scholarly community? What kind
within
of thing?
Scholarly community, I think there is an interest in the revolution and a desire to study it, but it's really limited, I think, and certainly, and it's fairly strong in the Academy of Sciences in Moscow and Petersburg, or particularly Petersburg, maybe. But the subject has been so politicized for so long that the expectation that many of us had when the Soviet Union crumbled that there would be a drive to learn more about the revolution in Russia just hasn't materialized to this day. And so that you just can't sort of gin up for a centennial and start saying really important and interesting things. Some people do because they're among the few that have worked on it, but not to the extent one would expect. There's a tremendous contrast, for one thing, between the celebration of the November 7th holiday, Revolution Day, in the Soviet Union, or beginning in 1918 in Soviet Russia. And today, there's a huge contrast between a celebration of a Victory Day, which is May 9th, I'll be there for it, in St. Petersburg. All the main streets will be closed. Hundreds of thousands of people will be demonstrating and marching about. I doubt if there'll be much in the way of protest. Maybe I'm wrong on that day, as there was in May Day, because many Russians feel really strongly about that day. Much more so than they do about May Day, and certainly more so than they do about November 7th now.
Do you get the impression that looking at the memory of the revolution and its commemoration this year from the level of, say, the Russian government, there's some obvious reasons why they would not really want to commemorate the revolution, because that's the collapse of the imperial regime, and that could, give too many ideas for the collapse of the current regime. But do you also think that one of the problems that they have is a problem of narrative? You know, how do you narrativize the 1917 in the long history of Russian history from the vantage point of the government?
I think that's really secondary, hugely secondary. I think the Colored Revolution has a huge impact. They see, what comes of revolution, what has come in many cases of revolution. And you see that actually, you see that in Europe today, and you see that in the United States. kind of a drive for stability. You certainly see it in the French election. I think those influences and the influence of the church and the church as a Orthodox church as a bulwark of the regime and a desire to stay in power, that is much more significant than trying to control the narrative.
Right. Yeah, I would definitely agree. And finally, you've called the October Revolution arguably the single most important historical development of the 20th century. And I don't think that's that controversial. I think most people would accept that. So you've already spoken a little bit about, say, the legacy in the sense of, you know, needing to deal with or address people's social status and poverty and frustrations. In addition to that, how do you understand its legacy today?
Well, its result was to stifle any form of democracy in Russia for the better part of a century. It resulted in the ultimate coming to power, although I don't think it was inevitable or foreordained, Stalin and the Stalinist terror. It led to the industrialization of the Soviet Union, but at the same time, it helped bring Hitler to power as a bulwark against Bolshevism. It stimulated revolutions, which admittedly weren't successful in the aftermath of October all around the world until about 1920-21. There's a direct link between it and the Cold War, and its legacy we still see today in the hostility, I think, in the sort of inbred hostility towards Russia among many Americans today, I think much more than I sense than towards China, and to some extent among Russians, although a lot of the hostility now is fostered by the propaganda that comes from the government. But there's still at a popular level. I'm not talking about scholars now, and I'm not talking primarily about the natives of St. Petersburg and Moscow, where there's always been a friendliness towards Russian Westerners. But at a popular level, I think I'm not directly familiar with it, but in the provinces and the countryside, where old ideas from the Soviet days are probably remain much stronger than they do in urban areas. There's a hostility that from those Soviet days. So all that is part of the legacy, it seems to me.
That was Alexander Rabinowitch. I learned that Alexander Rabinowitch died this morning at 91 years old, so I thought I'd re-release this interview of him. Alexander was a professor emeritus of history at Indiana University, where he taught from 1968 to 1999, and he wrote four excellent books on the Russian Revolution: Prelude to Revolution, The Petrograd Bolsheviks, and The July 1917 Uprising, The Bolsheviks Come to Power, The Revolution of 1917 in Petrograd, The Bolsheviks in Power, The First Year of Soviet Rule in Petrograd, and finally his fourth and last book, which was just published this April, The Bolsheviks Survive, Petrograd 1919, published by the University of Pittsburgh Press. I'm Sean Guillory, your host, and this is the Eurasian Knot, which is sponsored by the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Pittsburgh, and listeners just like you. I hope you enjoyed this revisiting of my conversation with Alexander Rabinowitch. If you like this and our other episodes, please consider becoming a patron by going to patreon.com/Euronaut. And if you can't do that, if money's tight, which it is for many of us, you can also help us out by sharing the show on social media and telling your friends, family, and whoever will listen to you to tune in and check us out. All right, until next time. Bye-bye. Народ кавказский, любим любовью ласки, если ж обманут глазки. Зимний дурной ходит и точит кинжалы, а потом ее тресим, чтоб не убежала.
somebody to help me through the night.
All our friends listening across the globe. It is an honor to have you here. All right, here are the seven agreements. I will always be open. I will always lead with integrity. I will always do my very best. I will always be appreciated. I will always listen better. I will always be of service. And I will always be honest. All right, there you go.
You got time, 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 time. You got time.
We are all learning every day. But sometimes we have to look in the mirror and ask ourselves, are we doing our best? What can I do differently to live the life I want to live?
Oh, the battlefield for my love. I'm a working, I am on the battlefield. I am a working for my love. Oh yes, I promised him that I would sing for him until I die. Yes, I am on the battlefield for my love. I was alone and I was idle. Wow. I was a sinner too. I heard a voice from heaven telling me that I've got some work to do. And then I took my master's hand, and then I joined that Christian man. Yes, I am on the battlefield for my Lord. I left my friends and kindred, bound for the promised land. Grace of God upon me, the Holy Bible in my hand. So in distant lands I try, crying out, sinners, come back. Knarren statt knarren, yes, I am on the battlefield. I'm working for my Lord. Schwerter zu Pflugscharen, Gitarren statt knarren. When the saints go marching in, oh Lord, I want to be in that number. When all the saints go marching in, and when the saints go marching in, and when the saints go marching in, oh Lord, I want to be in that number. When all the saints go marching in.
Also,
this is for Sam.
The murdered boy, the murdered boy, the murdered boy. Oh, I was there. Didn't do what I should. Mama catch me with a licking and tell me to be good. When I was bad twice time, she shoved me in a hole and cut off all my fingers and laid them in a finger bowl. My mama killed me. My father grieved for me. My little sister I'm laid well under the almond tree. Oh, I love the car, and when I was feeling sad, I lay down on my daddy's floor and I feel good. And later, I got bad. Robbed hubcaps from the men and sold them to the women and stole them back again. And later, I had a car of my own, and a Hudson Harlem car, and rode the pretty lady, and oh, wanted to meet and said, there's a bad boy. I'm a so bad boy. They gathered their daughter. I heard what they said. Steer away from him, honey, cause that boy is bad. And though he's hungered and flashes that loop, steer away from his highway. He rides the wrong cause he's bad boy. I was so bad boy. My mama killed me.